Hey, this is Jen Johans at FilmIntuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen. Today's guest is one of my favorite crime writers working today. Megan Abbott is the author of such books as Dare Me, Give Me Your Hand, You Will Know Me, The Turnout, Beware the Woman, and the upcoming El Dorado Drive. Well, Megan, I am so thrilled to have you back. You're one of my favorite people, my favorite crime writers. It's always wonderful talking to you. So how are you doing?
I'm okay. As we were saying a little bit before we started recording, it's so nice to have the sunny distraction of Doris Day amid a rough winter for America. So I've been looking forward to this and talking about Doris Day, a much misunderstood, I would argue, figure.
Yes.
Culture.
Yeah, especially because her on-screen and off-screen personas and her life, it's just a fascinating woman. And I love that you wanted to do this. We're recording this, we should tell everyone, on Super Bowl Sunday. So this is our counter programming, and I love that. And this season, I'm kind of hoping to go to the lighter side or give people some more distractions. So I was excited. Yeah.
No, it was, I know we talked about different things to do before, but this, yeah, when you mentioned this, it seemed like the perfect antidote to, our current moment and just in general, a kind of heaviness. So, I think a neglect, in many ways, as I said, misunderstood, neglected figure. So it gives us a chance to sort of reframe her maybe for people that haven't really discovered Doris Day movies yet.
Yes, I remember the first time I started to maybe take her a little bit more seriously. My mom always enjoyed her movies, but I had a poetry professor. It was like English 112, and she was a feminist, and she'd been kind of punk, and her favorite actress was Doris Day, and she would like defend her and talk about, you know, what a badass she was. And just listening to her talk about her, I was even a bigger fan and curious to know more. So
excellent, cool.
Yes. And of course, as I'm talking to you, this is a few months ahead of your next book. I should say over at Poison Pen last week, we had Joseph Finder came for The Oligarch's Daughter, and an audience member asked, what are you reading right now? And he said, Megan Abbott's next book. Like, I have to read Megan Abbott. And yes. So I am so excited. I'm jealous of everyone with an arc right now, and I'm very anxious. So
I'm sure one will be wending its way to you soon.
Fingers crossed. Yes. Put that out in the universe. But I love your books, and I know everyone listening is a fan as well. So what can you tell us about your next title?
Yeah, this is called El Dorado Drive, and it's really, it's the first book I've written that's set in the Detroit suburb I grew up in, Grosse Pointe, and it's set in 2007, 2008, which was the,
recession.
Auto bailout occurred.
Yeah.
So it was the recession. It was the kind of collapse of that was sort of Wall Street crash, and but particularly for Detroit, it was when all the car companies were really quote unquote in danger. I mean, now it's a little more suspicious, but when you grew up in the Detroit area, certainly when I grew up, and it was car culture, everything was built around the car industry that made Detroit this kind of powerhouse, especially in the mid-century, which is what we'll be talking about today. But so it's set there, and it's really about a bunch of essentially women that were sort of country club ladies who lunch, whose husbands lose their job or their most of their money because of failures of the industry. So the women decide to find a money-making venture of their own.
Ooh, that sounds good.
Yeah, the way I talked about it, we've been talking about it, has been Goodfellas in a country club. And that is Goodfellas was a big inspiration in terms of structure. I mean, that probably only be apparent to me or to you, probably anyone who knows movies, because there's little nods to it in it. But it is really about, sort of a, in some ways, how women who I guess have never really had access to, never made money of their own,
Okay.
and finally have a chance to, and then to see what how they handle that.
Ooh, I love it. I can't wait for that. That'll be really good. Are you writing your next book after that?
It's barely started. I'm developing Eldorado Drive for TV right now.
Oh,
So
exciting.
I sold it. So I'm developing it with A24. So
Oh, that's great,
I'm
Megan.
hopeful.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So I've been working on that pilot, which is sort of weird when the book hasn't come out yet, and you're sort of, when you write for TV or film, of course, as you know, you have to think about it in different ways, and it's such a strange thing, because the intimacy of the novel, and then you start to think of it in more visual terms.
Yeah.
It's really interesting.
That's it. Yeah, taking the same story from a different angle. That's really, yeah, that would be challenging for sure. But I'm excited. I love Dare Me, of course, the TV adaptation. I mean, the novel is amazing, and I also loved that adaptation. Just, it was beautiful to look at. The actresses were fabulous. Of course, the writing, top-notch. The music was outstanding.
We had great music supervisors on that show. We were really lucky. They were really great. It's, I was just thinking of this in preparation to talk today about Doris Day. I remember one of the great needle drops in movie history for me is Heathers, where they start with Doris Day singing Que Sera, Sera. And what a needle drop can do, especially when there's sort of an irony, kind of conflict between what you're seeing and what you're hearing. So
Yeah.
it's often used in that capacity, because her songs have a, but they evoke a particular kind of femininity. So.
Yes. Yeah, that's so synonymous with Doris Day. And I loved when I was doing some research, reading about her, like developing her singing style after she had been in an accident, as a teenager, the car colliding with the train, as you know, and then afterwards with the surgery and the pins and stuff, which I could relate to, she was listening to the radio and just singing along and really loving all of the and trying to match pitch and doing all the things I think a lot of girls do in their room growing up. And I love that. And I love how she had a very German name. I think it was Kappelhoff, and they changed it today because of the way she sang a song. And yeah, so I talk to me about your love of Doris Day. Have you always been a fan or?
It really does go back to childhood for me. And you had mentioned your mom, my mom, I think,
Yeah.
turned me on to Pillow Talk, and was always a favorite, but really all of those Send Me No Flowers and The
Yes.
Thrill of It All and this sort of sex comedy in particular. And then in my 20s, my ex-husband and I, we was my husband at the time, which sounds so sophisticated to say, my husband at the time, but we just sort of made this effort. This is in the era of DVD stores dying, and in the case, our case, it was Kim's Video and Tower
Oh,
Video.
wow, yeah.
And we just sort of went, we just watched every Doris Day movie. So through her early 40s movies, where she's mostly the singer, the girl singer who,
Yes.
Is in this, and it sort of comes and sings a few songs, and Romance in the High Seas, and some of these nostalgia pieces she did. But then moving through her more complex work, and then to the really kind of postmodern sex comedies that maybe she's most famous for today, and then through just some of the bitter ends, some of the last few are not so great. But we just sort of went through them all. So I've always had such affection for her, and with I guess a recent guest of yours, Jack Pendarvis. He and I read a biography of Doris Day together a few years ago. So we sort of filled in. with some of the life details, like the injury, like so many artists, speaking, of Scorsese, who are sick, have sick or some kind of illness or incapacitated in their youth, and that sort of somehow they foment their creative imagination in that space.
Yeah, it's a trigger, and that's when they find a new way of expressing themselves or a new outlet. Yeah, absolutely. And when I was talking to Jack, he mentioned, I can't remember if it was on air or off air, that you guys have like a two-person book club where you read celebrity memoirs. And I mean, some of these are very, historical figures. You shouldn't just say they're just your regular memoirs. And then some of them are your everyday people. But I love that you guys read about Doris Day. And I think you said you've been talking about Doris Day with Jack for like ever, basically.
Yeah, literally, I think one of our first conversations, we met over email, oh God, like 15 years ago now, more than that, 20 years ago now. And I literally think one of our first emails was about Doris Day. I think it's probably he had read my first book, which is set in the 50s, and I'm sure I mentioned Doris Day in it. So it probably, yeah, probably came up right away. So we had a 20-year conversation about Doris Day going at this point.
Yeah, and it's fascinating when you watch like the progression of her career, as you were mentioning. I remember back when I was reviewing a lot of old catalog titles for Warner Brothers, they sent me a box set and it was like starting with, Romance of the High Seas and Starlift. And then by the end, you get to like with six, you get Egg Roll. So you've kind of seen the entire cross section of her career and everything she did. And some of the movies we're going to talk about today, I think, show her range and just the way that she would. Her subtleties and the way that she could go from genre to genre and kind of mix it up and just match whatever the mood of the piece was. And I think she, you're right, she's kind of misunderstood, doesn't get enough credit.
Yeah, and one of the reasons I suggested the ones I suggested, though, I think we both could have picked a few more that are they show that range and that notion that, she's not a housewife in any of these, or this different to people's ideas about her, and not this virginal frigid goddess in any of these, and all these sort of ideas. She's very self-actualized, as they would say, all of these, and I think really was in most of her movies, and somehow in the way that that can drift in persona, it's sort of like Cary Grant or Humphrey Bogart, any of these that are known by their persona, they really diminish what they really were capable of, and they kind of flatten it out. And I think she's been particularly suffered that because the era which she was most famous had the most insane gender and sex anxiety since movies began. There's just so much anxiety about women's behavior. So I think that's why I think that's part of the timing has frozen a different. And I guess like Grease, the play and movie, the song. Maybe more than anything has created that false perception. I mean, I love that song, but it doesn't have much to do with Doris Day, especially if you see the movies that we're going to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. She was kind of became like a punchline almost, like, oh, it's the oldest virgin, the world's oldest virgin. Just like some of her male contemporaries, James Cagney, who we're going to talk about later, got dismissed as like, oh, a tough guy or whatever. And they forgot all about these other films that he did and his wonderful range as well. But as far as female complexity and kind of not dismissing Calamity Jane, I think is a really fascinating film. It's one that, a lot of people have written about. There's been some reevaluation of it as an LGBTQ film with Secret Love being an anthem. And when they told Doris Day about that years later, she thought that was wonderful. I think it's a really fun one. I hadn't seen it in forever, so What were your thoughts on this?
Yeah, this side one I always loved, and like I think it's almost like you can't. I mean, I think it's so clearly a queer movie. It's almost impossible to watch any other way. And
Pretty
it's
much,
yeah, and that's kind of what I love about it because it's so free to, essentially you have Calamity Jane, sort of swooning for this military officer, while she immediately becomes attached to this young female singer in town, and they end up shacking up and
A
making a
woman's
home together.
touch.
A complete Boston marriage, and everything is like, this is sort of the, to get super gender theory about it, but one of the, I think it's Eve Sedgwick who first set this up, but the notion that the same-sex desire in American literature and therefore film, to the way to sort of get it in there, to smuggle it in, is you triangulate it through a heterosexual romance. And then that's what you see, in this movie, that is saying that she's in love with this man, but really, really the love is between these two women, and is quite feels quite sexist.
Complicated.
Yes, exactly.
Because there's betrayal there. Of course, it's convoluted. It's a movie of its time. So, you like the man I like, and then he likes you, and vice versa, and stuff like that. But at the heart of it, the big betrayal that feels like it hurts the most, or the biggest sense of heartbreak, is when the two women aren't together anymore, or when they have that falling out for a little bit.
Yes, it's devastating. It's because you feel their connection, and it's sort of the classic case of, who are seeing her crush and her crush kiss. It's like who's she jealous of here? And it's so clear. And Secret Love, of course, has all these shadings. It's a much like we'll see with Pillow Talk, which we'll talk about later, the subtext really is the text, and it's just a way of expressing a real genuine love between two women, without saying it. And that, yeah, I think that's the relationship that the movie spends the most time on, that treats the most seriously. So I think all signs point to that. And you get to see it, Doris Day, being, a kind of, a really like a badass in this, she's dressed in a butch fashion, as they would say, and she knows how to use a gun, and she's not afraid to start. Even the way she stands, if you look, Doris Day does not stand like this in other movies. She's really adopted this physical presence that feels so powerful. And I mean, I think, you could think about Joan Crawford in Johnny Guitar as
I
being,
was, yeah.
yeah. I mean, that's the sort of, darker, more noir version of it, just in terms of tone. But there is a big similarity with the way they wear those pants around all the men, and that feels so, out of place and yet in place in the Western. So it's just, it's kind of a dazzling movie in that, they have the two women, Doris Day and what's her name? Alan Ann McLary plays Katie, who they sing this house cleaning song together called, which is really, it's called A Woman's Touch. And I mean, it's so
It's
Katie.
so obvious, yes.
But it's so, it's not making fun of them or
No.
their feelings. As you say, that's the heartbreak in it that you feel the most keenly.
Yeah, and there's stuff with, like lassoing and gunplay, and there's so much. I love that you brought up Johnny Guitar, because I think these two movies together would be a really fascinating double feature. I did an episode on rodeo movies with Christa Faust, and I can imagine, she would write like an amazing piece on this. No, I think this is a really good one. I was glad that you chose it. It had been a long time. And then after this, of course, we have the film that she was proudest of as far as she her performance goes, and the actual, and I think maybe because she could relate to a lot of the things that were in it, is Love Me or Leave Me. And I know this movie means a lot to you.
This is a really, people need to see it. They haven't seen it because I do think that people have certain ideas about it. I don't know. But it is, putatively the sort of biography of Ruth Etting, the torch singer. There are a lot of, I mean, it's pretty faithful in many ways, but so it's set in the 20s when she was sort of reigned, and she was sort of famous for being dominated by a kind of low life gangster manager, and it led to some of the drama that you see in the movie. But James Cagney plays that gangster manager, and their relationship is so complex every turn, and this mix of transactional and other valences, that at every stage. I mean, it was written by Daniel Fuchs, who's really one of the best screenwriters. He wrote Crisscross, and he's really a great noir screenwriter. And this really is a noir at heart. And it's really maybe the best James Cagney performance among many. You can't believe that you feel sorry for him because he's pretty abusive and dominating, but and he's not trying to get you to like him either, but it's so fully human a performance.
The empathy, you understand, and there's something about the way Cagney cuts right to the core.
Yes. And I had read, you probably did too, that Dorsey was not sure if she could play this part, because would the public accept it? Because really, this is a woman that, for all intents and purposes, is using this man's feelings for her to advance her career, which is completely how you had to operate in that era, and to a certain extent, any era. But it's, I think she felt she would be unlikable, and but she did it anyway, and I think that tension makes the character feel more real in some ways, because you sense that she is a good person, but this is what she feels like she needs to do, and she doesn't feel like she's being dishonest. And then she just gets eventually sort of almost mowed down by hit him and his, it's just it's a really dark, in many ways, story. But hearing her, I mean, the reason I originally fell in love with it is to hear her sing songs in a different way. I mean, some of the songs sound very Doris Day and this and that voice, but that kind of crisp,
10 cents a dance, the way she does the line, the big come on, big boy, the way her delivery is totally different.
Totally different, especially with the ones, that Ruth Etting was most known for. Like, they don't judge, because some of the other ones, they kind of judge up, and they feel more like, sound more like 50s songs than 20s. But the ones that they don't put too much of that arrangement on, she does do like a torch singing delivery, and she's, this is a different way of standing from Calamity Jane, but she stands like Ruth Etting was famous for, the way she would stand, which is this sort of super masculine way where she would leave on her legs would be apart, her feet would be apart, and she would, her hips would be forward and squared, and is very dominant. And to see, she's so sexy in the part, and incredible when she's singing. And then you pair that with this kind of really fraught relationship that keeps turning and turning, and ultimately, as you alluded to, is very much both about her life, and these echoes both about her before, because she was married to an abusive man, and then ongoing, because her husband became, I think already was by the time this movie came out, her manager, Martin Meltzer, who would eventually,
Oh, third husband, yep.
He would eventually bankrupt her. So he was running her career, much as James Cagney's character is running her character's career in this, for to bad ends. So yeah, it's just so rich and chewy, a movie.
Yeah, and unfortunately, she had bad luck right out of the gate. She got married at 17, one of those like, but I love him. Everyone was telling her not to. Even the guy's mom warned her that he was violent. And so I think this probably did hit home. I think what you were saying too about her being nervous about playing this part and the unlikability, she has like a swagger here that you don't normally associate with Doris Day. You would associate it, of course, for this role, who she's playing, and it's perfect. And I know Cagney actually recommended her. They had been in a movie together in the 40s, and Spencer Tracy turned down the Cagney role. It was supposed to be Ava Gardner, and she turned it down, and MGM was so pissed off, they actually like suspended her salary temporarily. And but then Doris Day got in. I think, you know, it's a remarkable performance. There's a lot to the relationship, just like we were talking about Johnny Guitar being a good companion piece to Calamity Jane. This one, I think, like Party Girl, the Nick Rae movie, because you have a disabled lead and this like complicated really of a sexy woman, and is she the one in charge of the relationship and what is going on, and also some criminal elements. It's yeah, there's a lot to this one, I think.
I think it's there are a lot of parallels in noir movies in general to this, as you often see these transactional romances that are disastrous usually, and I think that is just sort of humming through this. And I think it would have been like, look, I would love to see Ava Gardner in every movie,
Oh,
but I think she would have been, she would not, it would not have been as complex a movie,
I don't
because she
think so.
would be vamp, you know, she's so beautiful, you know, it would just like, it would feel in some ways like a more traditional noir relationship where they're both kind of manipulating each other, which to a certain extent they are here. But I think again that Doris Day is able to project this integrity that
Yeah, like she doesn't want to, but she knows she has to.
she believes in her voice and she believes in herself, and she does get beaten down by him, but she's still able to lift herself out of that. It just, it changes it, and in that way it makes it feel, I think, more three-dimensional than it might not, might have been if a standard femme fatale, like an actress known for playing femme fatales, would grant this. So I think that, you know, really now I want to think of all the Ava Gardner parts. What if Doris Day had played them?
Oh, that would be
Yeah,
interesting.
that's a thought experiment. That's,
Exactly.
yeah, it's interesting. But yeah, it's just, I think people probably,
She would have been almost, I mean, and Doris Day is extremely sexy in this, but
yes.
maybe a little too va-va-voom, and it would have almost been a signal like we're watching noir instead of we're watching this complicated human story that happens to have these other elements,
That's
maybe.
right. That's right. That's right. And it's somehow, it's just sort of more, the relationship is even more upsetting, I think, because of, you feel Doris Day adding, you know, you feel her, constant roiling anxiety. Like, how long am I going to be able to get away with this? Like, what am I really doing here? Am I, you know, you just, and it, you know, it really takes some dark turns. But it has an amazing ending, and I won't spoil it, but it's both dark and not dark, and it really interesting, and just, you know, again, just shows how, sophisticated, like how grown up, I guess, the screenplay is. It's not,
Yeah, I'd forgotten.
melodramatic. Yeah.
I remembered a showdown that occurs, I'll say
Yes,
without like
yes.
spoiling anything, but I didn't remember what happened after that. Like, wow.
Yeah, and it really, and it added part is based on real life, which makes it all the more. So yeah, I hope some people start to rediscover that one, which is easily streamable if you don't have a hard copy, so.
Yes, I would say of the movies, this one was probably one of the easiest to find for sure. So if you haven't seen Love Me or Leave Me, we're saying, you know, check that out for sure. And let's see, after that,
Pajama
chronologically,
Game, yeah, Pajama Game, I think, is next.
yes, 1957. So have you ever seen the stage musical of this at all?
No,
I haven't either.
I haven't. Yeah,
Yeah.
I mean, I think I discovered this. I'm sure I saw it for Doris Day, but I think I also then saw it through when I was watching all Bob
I
Fosse.
was going to say that that was my gateway too, because I'm a huge Fosse head. So yeah.
Yeah, and you immediately realize that it's Bob Fosse, that
Oh,
even
the
if you don't
type,
see him,
yes.
there's the hats, there's Carol Haney, there's the way the body movements are, and it's a great early Bob Fosse
Yeah,
rendering.
Steam Heat, of course, became one of his
Yes.
like most famous numbers. There was a really good, I'm sure you saw that Fosse
Yes.
special years
Fosse.
ago.
Yes,
Yes.
yes, yes.
Yeah, it's
Yes,
wonderful.
and it's so makes it so distinctive, and it has like that number and Hernando's Hideaway and Hey There. It's just chock full. This is George Abbott and Stanley Donen, and it's just chock full of these amazing songs. But what I always, once again, here she's playing a strong union member. I mean, it's really about
Yeah.
a union management
In Iowa.
song.
Yeah, which I love. Yeah.
And I love how forceful pro-union she is in this. And she, this is the sort of love story at the center is between her and management. I would say to me, one of the weaknesses of the movie is John Raitt, who I know played him famously on Broadway, played that character on Broadway.
Yeah.
He's not quite comfortable on film. And here, what did you think of him?
I wasn't a huge fan of him either. I kind of wondered what it would have been like with a different lead for sure.
Yeah, I mean,
Yeah.
I would have put Howard Keel in it. Although, he would have been,
Ooh, that would have been really good. Yeah.
because he seems to stay. Yeah, even the way he stands is sort of like a Broadway. He
Yeah.
stands
Yeah,
like,
because I'm thinking about him and like, Brigadoon and which was a couple of years. Yeah, he would have been great in that.
But it is so she's so forceful in her convictions, and she believes in her union, and I think there's something so thrilling about that, I guess, maybe in our current moment in particular, to have such a and really it's the surprising in some ways that this was a 1957, or what is it, 57 movie, given the anti-union feelings during the McCarthy era. But it doesn't present the union as perfect, but it definitely presents them as correct in this situation. And I think even on a basic human level, the managerial practices are very suspect in this movie.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And she's the grievance committee, which
Yes.
I love that
Named
idea.
Babe. I mean, what more could you want?
Yeah, her name's Babe. Yes, exactly. The cutest grievance committee I've ever had to deal with, as he says. But she actually investigates the claim. She isn't like you go to HR and they just sort of say yes to you and yes to them and nothing happens. Like somebody gets shoved and do they even have a bruise and trying to figure that out. So there's some stuff there. There's a couple weird subplots in this, like the knife throwing and the jealous guy who wants to like, go after or kill his young girlfriend. There's some weird things that kind of distract us along the way, but the story with Doris Day is amazing. I love a lot of the numbers in the factory. It's Stanley Donen and was it George Abbott? Was that? Yeah.
I don't even know if I think those dark, maybe this is something I've come to decide about it, but I think those dark undertones are actually rich, enriching it, because I guess it's a sort of David Lynch idea that the sunnier it is, the dark, especially small towns, small cities,
Oh, the more there is underneath. Yeah, yeah.
because there is this sort of, much like I say, I just Blue Velvet's been on my mind, like, as I just watched it this week, and There's something about that, the small town with the secret club, Hernando's Hideaway, and the obsessive love relationships that feel like they're gonna turn to violence. This is, of course, the era of Oklahoma, which is sort of famous for having a very dark.
Yes, yeah.
So I
And
think
Carousel was dark. I mean, my
Carousel,
goodness.
totally,
Yeah.
exactly. Better example. And I think in some ways I just don't think there's good at putting the two together in this, but I think I don't think I think it's a little jumble, the pieces don't quite fit together, but
Yeah, but it's
like
interesting.
it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I like how full of a desire Doris Day and all the women in it, they all want to have sex and
Yes.
they're all
I
really
mean, they're making pajamas. Yeah.
yeah. And they're all like openly expressing desire for the
Yeah.
hot new manager and I think that stuff and they're having furtive affairs and that
Yeah.
also I mean this is again another movie yeah where Doris Day is far from virginal but someone with active desire that she actually only sort of sets aside for the sake of reunion which is great.
Yeah, like the scene where they're waiting for the dad to leave so they can hook up,
Yes.
basically. Yeah, that's quite
Yeah.
sexy. Or when they're in the kitchen, and yeah, but
She
she
looks
wants to.
great. She's got great costumes. She's
Yeah.
dressed very, this is real 50s, like tiny waist, big tits
It
era.
is, yes. Yeah, and I like also what you were saying about Blue Velvet. You mentioned that because there is sort of like with the dark subplot in this. I mean, you have and trying to get access to a key and getting the and the woman is sloshed and then sneaking around and a book and secrets. So it's a little, yeah, there's a little Lynch, or Lynch might have enjoyed this one. Yeah.
Yes, I have no doubt that he saw it.
Yes. Yeah. No, this is a good movie. And like we were saying, if you're a Fosse fan, you love Cabaret and you love all that jazz, you're going to want to check this out. Sweet Charity. You can kind of see the evolution of Fosse for sure. Yes.
Totally, totally. And I guess that brings up to like probably, I guess maybe her most famous movie, would you say? Pillow Talk.
Yeah.
Yeah, I
The one
think.
synonymous with her, probably.
Yeah,
Yeah.
yeah. And that sort of gave her a whole second career, because,
Yeah.
as we've sort of articulated, she was mostly musicals, before this. And this is, really getting to see her at this extremely strange moment in mores around sex and dating, but also getting her to play as really a sophisticated New York City career woman, which also she hasn't got to do that. That's she looked these amazing
Yeah.
gowns and these
Which made
beautiful.
her nervous because,
Yes.
yeah, the costumer had to say, like, you're a sexy woman. You're allowed to show your figure. And yeah, I think that is a good point, Megan. She really hadn't done too much comedy. Rock Hudson was super nervous about doing comedy. He actually almost bailed on it because he hadn't done comedy, and she told him we have chemistry, and she said that he would be great, and they were so good together in this movie.
I mean
Ugh.
that's what the movie depends on, and it's like you think you like we can you really see electricity on screen, and you can between them,
Yes, they
whatever.
genuinely like each other, and
Yes, and
you
you
can't
feel
fake that. No.
no, they're having so much fun. I always think of the piano bar scene when they sing
Yes,
Roly Poly
Roly-Poly.
song, and you can tell they almost feel you almost feel like they're gonna have to break scene because they are having so much fun that they're laughing and they keep making each other laugh, and it's like what a smart director, Michael Gordon, to like let that be part of the scene that they it feels very natural that they are having the time
Yeah.
their lives and
Yeah, because one or both of them is always kind of winking at the audience
yes.
because we're in on the joke. She said, of course, that she couldn't play things funny. It wasn't, she had to play it as serious as possible, even when it was ridiculous, and that's what made it work. And I love that in this movie because you have Rock Hudson playing like a dual character, like this ultra macho guy with the southern accent, the Texas twang, and it's just, you can tell, like, as he's doing the accent and getting further and further, she's having a hard time kind of keeping it real, even though she's trying to play it serious. It's visually just a stunning film. Some of the production design and the use of the car that's tiny because Rock Hudson can't fit in it. I mean, so much good stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, you got the split screen, the famous split screen from
Yes.
I mean, the conceit is that yeah, they share a party line and they're both these sort of he's a sort of ladies' man songwriter.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so she's immediately it's really classic romantic comedy in that way, that they take this instant dislike to each other that then of course turns into this wild attraction. But for a long stretch of the film he has to play this like Texas hayseed guy who seems to be gay, and of course
Yes.
the whole
The subtext with
much
Rock
like
Hudson.
Calamity Jane,
Yeah.
going Rock Hudson as sort of an open secret in Hollywood. The movie has all these added complexities because of that. Moreover, you really see it in this one, but in really most of the sex comedies she did, this is like really when Freudian thought really overtook the pop culture. So not only do you have everyone having an analyst,
Yeah.
but you also have these sort of Freudian inflected ideas about, he's close with his mother, he must be gay, like that kind of stuff that but also the notion of
Hadn't tried to make advances or that kind of
Yes,
thing.
right. And this is like Doris Day is again not virginal in this. She really wants him badly,
Yeah.
and he's sort of playing it, and it's really about power. That's the only thing that delays consummation is that, the risk of sex feels in most 50s, especially late 50s movies, feels very dangerous. And you feel that here too, because this is really, when there's really kind of, this is the opposite of pre-code, right? There's this notion that you must have the company job and have the nuclear family and have the 2.5 kids. And so anything that's out of that norm feels very subversive. So that's humming through it. So there's all these, again, these layers to watch it through, such that each time you watch it, you realize there's more going on than you thought.
Yeah, because there's this idea that goes through this and Touch of Mink as well, like if she should go out of town with this man, which means sleep together. And in this case, it's like, would she be having sex under false, pretenses because he's lying to her? So it does feel dangerous and it feels like we don't want someone to take advantage of Doris Day in that way. So that's interesting. I talked about this movie a little bit last spring with Nell Minow. We did an episode on Thelma Ritter, and this movie, just like a lot of these, the supporting cast just kind of steals it. Like Tony Randall, any scene he's in, he just walks away with it. Thelma Ritter, the quartet is amazing. This is the film she, Doris Day and Thelma Ritter were both nominated for Academy Awards. You would think maybe like Love Me or Leave Me should have gotten her a nomination, but this was the one. Yeah.
Yeah, and really, you could definitely watch this movie for Thelma Ritter alone, because she's
Yeah.
one of the funny,
In
her and Rock Hudson, I mean, talk about chemistry. She and Rock Hudson
the bar.
the bar is one of the funniest scenes I've ever seen in my life. But it's sort of like these side characters always get like one note that they have to play over and over again, and they're so good that they find new ways to do it. So
Yeah.
Randall is this sort of neurotic, and Thelma Ritter is alcoholic, which is hilarious.
Yes.
It's always hilarious. But she's just kid hasn't bottomless capacity to hold her liquor.
Yes.
And it's just a really truly bravura performance. So yeah, these are ones where like everything is working perfectly. You know, it looks great, the chemistry's there, the supporting cast is killer, you know, it just has all the pieces. And it just works. And I, you know, there are other ones, you know, I really love you know, all the ones she did with Rock Hudson and James Gardner, they're all kind of
Oh my
great.
goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thrill of it all. I love Send
Oh.
Me No Flowers is one of my faves. I'd Love Her Come Back is also subversive. Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, and Move Over, Darling, of
Over
course.
Darling, right? Yes, God, yes. But I think this and Thrill of It All, I'm especially fond of because she plays a career woman. Some of these, she does
Yeah.
like a housewife, and she's always an interesting housewife, but there's nothing wrong with housewives, but again, just trying to show that there was more to her than these sort of ideas
Yeah.
about her as being wholesome, and she's, you know, she's not wholesome here. She's a full-blooded woman,
Yeah.
you
Yeah,
know.
she's feisty. I love at the end. Oh, you know, she wants the phone inspector because she can't get through. And then at the end of the movie, she takes revenge in a really funny way with her interior design. Yes. I remember when I was talking to Nell, one of the things she loved about Thelma Ritter's character in this is Thelma gets, you know, a love interest of her own. And so there's like, you know, supporting, like romantic plots that pay off, which is good. So this is, you know, it's showing women in different avenues of their life. And I think when we think of Doris Day, we just assume head in the clouds or, you know, this sort of, like you said, the Grease, Look at Me, I'm Sandra Dee song. And yeah, there's a lot going on with this woman, and her relationship too with the Tony Randall character is good. She doesn't want to take advantage or lead somebody on if they don't have chemistry. She's very upfront about that.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. And I think where you see more of maybe where this stereo comes from is actually the next couple we'll talk about, where I think you really see the era showing itself, and also the way Hollywood treats women of a certain age, which I can't imagine them is, you know, we don't get that kind of vibrancy, though. I, you know, maybe we should talk about A Touch of Mink next, just because it's so, yeah, because this is the one that I think can drive people crazy.
It did. Yeah. I hadn't seen it probably since like high school. And when I watched it again, it's like I liked some elements and then some drove me nuts. Now, I will say what was interesting is watching it after Calamity Jane. There's so much gay subtext in this movie. It's amazing. Just like, well, Pillow Talk. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And I think one of the things that I used to sort of be kind of down on, so it's, you know, this pairs her with Cary Grant, and here, you know, she is a career woman, but she's seeking employment, and Cary Grant, you know, one of these amazing ways people meet in these movies is that his fancy car splashes her with
With
a,
mud.
yeah. And great, but this, you know, the whole, you know, he's a ladies' man, and the whole, you know, the whole notion is like, you know, can she resist and ensnare him at the same time? But I've come to really think it's actually maybe the most subversive of these movies because it really shows how you cannot win as a woman.
That's true. Yeah, because even at the end, I mean, I don't want to spoil everything, but yeah, it's an inverse.
Right, because she clearly wants him from the start. She knows that what will result in that. She knows what women are, how women are discarded, and that your job in that era as a woman is to not surrender yourself without a ring, you know. And the movie has no respect for that notion, but it understands that that's the sort of rule of the culture. But that's therefore She and then eventually even Cary Grant are so full of sort of repression that their bodies start to like manifest, you know. They break out in the hot, you know,
Yes.
they're, you know, it's a real Freud hysteria situation where the body speaks what they cannot, which is that they should be free just to be able to have sex freely and unencumbered by the mores of the day, but that this crazy culture at the time would not
Yeah,
live that.
the Puritanism and what's going on. It's kind of a weird to have revisited the Doris Day films in this era of people being so afraid of sex and like what's ahead in the future. And yeah, I know it was interesting because I went in thinking one thing. And then you realize, wow, these movies really were much more subversive. Yeah. And another one that involves analysts and of the time, this was the first film that made over $1 million and it got her in the top 10 in the 60s. She was the only female star to be in that top 10. So it was very important for her career. She has said different things about working with Cary Grant, that he was very professional, but they didn't really have a give and take or a very warm relationship like she and Rock did. Cary Grant was very particular. He had a lot of input though on how the movie should look, right down to the car, the clothes. He even helped pick out her stuff. He knew, I think, from years and years, like what people expected maybe when they went to one of his movies or the Escapist Fantasies or whatever, but he wanted to kind of have that elegant quality. And so it looks great. Yeah.
No, and I think that's a really good point. You know, I remember reading that recent Cary Grant biography. I think it's Scott Eiman. I think that
Oh,
wrote
yeah.
it so good. And one of the things, this was really seemed correct to me, but that Cary Grant understood early on that he needed to not be the pursuer in his movies romantically, that it had
Yes.
to be the women. And this is structured such that that doesn't work. So I think he was very uncomfortable with being the seducer. They tell you know, and I think that started when he was young because he's so handsome, like so impossibly handsome, and
Yeah.
so overwhelmingly charming that it just upset the balance, and it instead became this great opportunity for these actresses that he worked with so many times and so well that they would be the pro, you know, you have like, you know,
Yeah.
Arthur or Katharine Hepburn or any, you know, who
Irene
are perfectly,
Dunne. Yeah.
perfectly willing to take the lead. And I think here, because the story is the way it is, that's impossible. So you sort of do feel his discomfort, but that kind of works for what we're talking about in terms of how impossible these social roles are for them.
Yeah, and I think when you kind of have this in the middle of the movie she was making with Rock and James Garner, you could kind of see this is the Where's Waldo, or the one that doesn't quite work like the other ones do in that respect. And I think it's maybe because of what you were saying that he really wasn't comfortable playing that part. Yeah.
As one of the great automat scenes of all time, I will flag for people who like there's so much in it that but yeah, you do feel like it can't it, you know the movie can't contain these social contradictions anymore. Like it's exploding, and that's where you get, you know, think her she's, you know, a lot of the comedies she does after this are become pretty hackneyed.
Yeah.
You know, they're no longer even, well, I mean, again, they don't know what to do with a woman, like a 40-year-old woman.
No, they just keep, doing the same thing again. Like one of my author friends, Jen McKinley here, likes to say is every time she turns in a book, they're like, "We want the same but different." Yeah,
Exactly.
exactly. That's what
Which
she
is,
was kind of going through.
yes, totally. Which I think is why Midnight Lace is so interesting.
Yeah.
Because it puts her in a different genre. So, and, And it's such a fascinating and odd movie. What did you, had you seen it before or?
It had been a while, and it's interesting now that I'm thinking about it. It might have been our one of our first conversations might have involved Doris Day. Didn't you have a poster for Julie?
I do. Yeah, in fact,
Yes,
I asked that. Yes.
I think that was like an icebreaker thing. I saw it in the background and I'm like, oh my God,
Yes.
it's Julie. And you
Yes.
were like, you know this movie? Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's the two, Julie and Midnight Lace. If you want to see Doris Day in odd thrillers where her husbands are crazy and maybe scary, you need to see these movies, is what
Yes,
we're
it's
saying.
a real gaslight thing, real gaslight story, particularly in this one. And here it's like this hybrid. There's a little dial-M for murder. In fact, it has a lot of the same
Yeah.
actors. It has two of the same primary actors from dial-M for murder, but it also has, because this is a Ross Hunter production, like Imitation of Life and all these sort of sumptuous melodramas from the period, it's so ornate. The clothes are so over the top. Everything
Yeah.
so lush,
It's
and it,
overwrought in
yeah,
places. Yeah.
gorgeous. Her, these fur hats and muffs she has. I mean, she looks incredible.
Yes, and the fog is like the
Fog,
most.
eerie, strange. And there's something really scary about the movie to me. I will say, there's it's both goofy and therefore scary. I mean, it calls to mind David Lynch again. There's, she's being taunted by this unknown caller, and his voice is
Yeah.
very strange and almost feels like David Lynch would have invented the voice, because it's kind of comedic and but unmoored, and the unreality of the setting. It's supposed to be London, doesn't really seem like London most of the time, and doesn't really. All of it feels unreal, and it did remind me this time of like a giallo movie. In that everything is so beautiful and artificial in a good way, and scary, and it almost like the giallo movies, with the clubbed killer. It
Yes.
just seemed very, it really evoked that for me, and it made me wonder if Baba was lurking somewhere in the background here. Is this, it's not violent like that, and part of, most of it's really more of a comedy of manners, with a dark sort of tinge, but the thriller elements, feel there's a really eerie quality that I associate with giallos, where everything feels vaguely psychotic under the candy-colored surface.
Yeah, visually, I can totally see that comparison too, especially like I said, the fog and the elevator and the way it all looks. Yeah, but I think what is so frightening to me about these gaslight pictures is this idea of, and I'm sure Doris Day, of course, could relate to this because she had been in an abusive relationship, and people, including her own mother, who they were very close, was like, well, you don't look too badly beaten, or that kind of thing. Like, this idea where you say something is going on and people either don't believe you or try to undermine it. Like, it's not that bad. Like, she's getting, dirty phone calls, heavy breathers, that kind of thing. Now, she is somebody who seems to have a great deal of anxiety. She's very histrionic. The way she's directed in this movie, she gets on your nerves pretty fast, like a midway through, but you just want somebody to help this woman. And
Right, and that
so,
kind of works for the story
yeah.
because people don't take her seriously.
Yes.
It seems like a hysterical rich lady,
Exactly.
and it
Like,
made me,
she's bored. She wants attention.
yes, that's
Yeah.
right. She wants attention, and that, all those charges are laid at her. And I think, it, the director David Miller directed one of my favorite noirs, Sudden Fear, which is not dissimilar in
Ooh,
plot.
yeah.
And that features one of the great Joan Crawford
You
performances.
bet.
I
Yeah.
think that in some ways is so superior, because it, in there, there's a better match of tone of movie and performance, but it's
Yeah.
performance.
This might have had too many cooks then with the,
Yeah, I think
yeah.
that, yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, it's part of what makes it fascinating, all these sort of different genres sort of, you know, blended together. But it's that movie, Sudden Fear, is kind of a perfect suspense movie. It's just so well done. And this feels a little more messy, but nonetheless fascinating. And I think Rex Harrison and she are like a fascinating couple too. They seem
Yeah.
so,
So
I mean,
mismatched, yeah.
yes. And there's, you know, it's like meta with Doris Day, who not only had that abusive first husband, but has a current husband who's
Yes.
completely running her life. And
Yep.
Rex Harrison is sort of famous for having many wives and being a terrible
Yeah.
husband. So they're like, again, we have these meta narratives humming underneath it that I think make it even richer.
Yeah, what we're saying is people need to write big critical studies and reevaluations of all of these movies and like what was really going on.
Yes,
Yes.
exactly.
Yes. No, I was glad to revisit this one. So other films, I know we kind of struggled with just choosing a handful because her career is so fascinating. Are there any others that you want to recommend that people should check
Yeah, I mean,
out?
I certainly would recommend all of the other Rock Hudson and James Garner.
Yeah.
They're just so delightful and smart and surprising, and they're all like 90 minutes, and they're just so delicious, and such a like Mad Men. It's the real Mad Men era, you know.
Yeah.
They all look great and are sort of these lovely studies. But you know, I think they all. I mean, Please Don't Eat the Daisies. We talked about that a little bit.
Yeah.
That's always been one of my favorites,
That's
which.
one of my mom's favorites. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that she plays, you know, it's a playwright, and his wife, and sort of, I don't know what I loved about that. I mean, I still love it, but I really, as a kid, that one I just could watch over and over again. It's very funny, and not a playwright, a theater critic, right? He's a theater critic.
Yes. David Niven. Yeah.
Yes, and they have like tons of children in the suburbs, and
They're all wild, yeah.
So that's another great one. Are there any other ones that you love?
I don't know if I loved it, but I do find it fascinating for those midnight lace reasons, Julie, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. So I think just,
Oh,
do
and
a
Young at
deep dive.
Heart. Yeah, we almost did Young at Heart.
Oh, yes. That
Is
has
she?
one of my favorite sequences to show the passage of time. I like it when people do that creatively, where you see the dog running on the beach and
Yeah.
it goes from like a puppy to it eventually becomes like a full-size dog. I love that. Yeah.
Wow. Okay, I didn't even remember that. It is one of the great, like Sinatra and she have really,
Yeah.
again, like sparkling and really erotic chemistry in that movie,
Yes.
I think. And it's I think that's a great one. And you know, the music is wonderful in it. And it's really a great Sinatra performance. So
It is.
that one's worth it too, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Megan, I want to thank you so much for doing this. It's always such a pleasure. You'll have to
Oh,
come
thank you.
back.
Yes, definitely. This was a great way to not watch football.
Yes, 100%.
I also want to thank everyone for listening, especially my patrons who support the show and help fund my research equipment, film rentals, RSS fees, and more for as little as a dollar per month at the Film Intuition Patreon, which is the home base for the show. Other ways you can support the podcast are by sharing, reviewing, and subscribing to Watch with Jen wherever you get your podcasts, and also checking out the cool merch store hosted and created by our talented logo designer, Kate Gabrielle. You can find the merchandise store, including shirts, tote bags, stickers, and more, by visiting filmintuition.com and clicking on the shop link. The show's theme music is Solo Acoustic Guitar by Jason Shaw and is available in the free music archive. Well, until next time, please take care and happy movie watching.
This is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.